Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcio Land Podcast. So we have a fun episode today. At the top, we are going to talk about one of Alex's least favorite players, Morata, who is doing quite well at Juve. We'll also take a look at the crowded Juve front line a bit. Then we haven't spoken much about Lazio recently. We are going to make up for that today. We have a great guest, Alistair McKenzie. We haven't had him on in quite some time, so he offered some great perspective on Lazio. Of course, we're recording Friday morning. We have Serie A coming this weekend, so we have our friend Thousand Names with his game picks today. And typical once a month, we have a Napoli outsider on today. Treat for everyone. You guys on this episode will hear him talk just about Napoli. Our patrons already heard that version of the interview with a much longer part on all of Serie A. So if you enjoy hearing Napoli outsider, and if you're listening to this pod, I can't imagine that you don't, consider becoming a patron because it's well worth it just to hear him. And then I had Alex listen to Eruption from Van Halen, so we'll get his take at the end. I'm very curious to hear. I haven't asked him yet, so we're going to find out at the end. But before we get to all that, I want to start on Morata, because this is interesting to me, because we know Alex is familiar with quite a few players, and obviously Morata was at Chelsea, and that was an absolute bust, I have to say. Maybe in the history of Calcioland, my worst take was how convinced I was that Morata was going to do well at Chelsea, and then it turned out to be an absolute disaster. But he's back at Juve, had a brace in the Champions League, scored against Crotone. He's been absolutely invaluable with Ronaldo positive for COVID and Dybala not yet in game shape. So I want to ask you this, Alex. Two things. A, are you surprised by his fast start? And B, in general, you know, sometimes we talk about, you know, trying to get an opportunity, getting a player that was in a bad situation. And we see this maybe more in the NBA more than anything, teams that target a player who was drafted by a bad team. And they're like, you know, if we bring him here, it's going to all work out because he'll be in a better situation. But it feels like Morata, maybe it's even beyond that. It's not necessarily getting out of a bad situation. It feels like he almost has to be at a place like Juve where he's really comfortable. So let me ask you, what do you make about that? Do you think Morata is one of those players that needs to be in that environment? And do you think this scenario is more common, or he's more of an exception?
I think you're bang on the money. In fact, normally I'm known as somebody who will be long-winded, but the best way I can answer this is echo what you said, that it is specific for Morata, where it could be night and day based on where he is. And I just think club, sure, some players are meant to be at one club or another, but also just league and country. So it was very clear after Morata faced some adversity at Chelsea after that good initial start where his Spanish compatriot assisted him every time, Azpilicueta. Once that turned south, I mean, it was very clear he wasn't made for English media, English press, the whole life in London. And I am friendly with many nice Chelsea journalists, and they have all said, hey, we give players chances over and over and over to be rude to us, but then be kind, you know, to kind of maybe correct how they act, because they can get it hard from us and fans, etc. Morata never made it easy on anyone. The word I always heard from even the nicest people was he was miserable, and he made everyone else miserable. So, all right, not going to work at Chelsea. You see those cases. He goes back to Italy in this case, but like, even if he went to Spain, David, I think he'd kick on. I really do. So I'm not surprised, to answer the first part of your question, I'm not really surprised that he's off to a nice start here with Juve. There's comfortability. He probably feels like, to a certain extent, he still is needed more. Even though, of course, he was signed to be Chelsea's leading man, I still think that the situation he's in, almost more nurturing of Morata. And in England, if you're signed to be a striker, and I'm not saying it isn't this way in Italy, but if you're signed to be a striker and you're not kicking on consistently, or you're flopping around like a fish, and you had Drogba at the club famously, you're screwed. I mean, you're absolutely screwed, and Morata couldn't deal with it. But I'm not saying that, once again, there wouldn't be adversity he'd face in Italy if he didn't go well. But everything's just set up for him a lot better. And yeah, sometimes it's just about where feels best, where you're more comfortable. I always reference the Ciro Immobile thing where someone at Lazio is like, yeah, hey, Ciro partly does well because he's so freaking comfortable in this situation, from the life off the pitch to just knowing he's going to training with this bunch of teammates and this coaching staff. Like, it has to be set up for some players. And the reason why I said that this is so perfect for me to answer, even though now I've gone long-winded, is we're going through the same exact thing with Kepa right now. And we kind of went through the same thing with Bakayoko. Bakayoko's first season at Chelsea was so disastrous that all parties admitted, okay, maybe he just shouldn't return, even after he had a good stint at AC Milan. Like, that was a good enough stint where some were like, well, should we take him back? No, because he just won't be the same Bakayoko, and it's okay. That happens. Everyone's human. He's just not meant to be a Chelsea player. He's not meant to play in London, and that was a very damaging year. And Kepa, it's really the exact same thing as Morata. Got off to a good start, but man, we learned a lot about his mentality that once things went south, and we also did hear reports, very credible ones, that Kepa got complacent about having his number one job. He couldn't take criticism very well. So yeah, it's a lot his doing too, but it comes a certain point where you actually feel bad for the human. And I was starting to feel bad for Morata. It was just, he was in our face and he was really frustrating us. So you feel bad for the human, and somebody has to put their hand up and say, it's just not going to work here. And I guarantee you, if Kepa goes to Spain or another country, he's not going to be elite, but he'll probably go back to being a good goalkeeper. So I think it could be very similar to the Morata situation. So we know, I mean, that's a keeper. That's a heavy confidence position. So is striker David. We know Morata, I've always said he's a confidence player. So that's a good and a bad thing. When he's going well, his confidence actually propels him. It multiplies and multiplies. So if he's scoring, maybe he's even doing better than his ability. He has good ability, but maybe he's even doing better than his ability because that confidence is sky high. But it's also his curse. When he starts doing poorly, ooh, he cannot stop having it snowball. But I think back in Italy, back at Juve, it doesn't snowball as much. There's much more comfortability. So I totally give 1,000% credence to everything you said. Some players are just meant to succeed at certain clubs or certain leagues and not other ones, but they could still be really good at those clubs they're meant to succeed at. So yeah, spot on, David. So, all right. Morata, I mean, he's somebody, when I think of Juve, I'm still not like thinking of him as somebody to lean on, but hey, maybe they will. But to kind of broaden up, how do you see Juve's front line evolving once Ronaldo returns and then Dybala is fit? Because those are two huge people, especially after Juve have added Kulusevski and Chiesa.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think this still falls under a good problem to have, but pretty fascinating, because especially if Morata somewhat keeps this form. And look, you know, on top of everything else that you mentioned on why he's comfortable there, like he had his best moments probably as a player, certainly the ones that I watched in that run in the Champions League with Juve his first time around, and Pirlo was his teammate, and now he's his manager. So let's assume, you know, I don't expect him to keep up this unbelievable pace, but I do expect him to be a factor. And it was interesting that when Morata arrived instead of Dzeko, my reaction was like, you know, in some ways this makes sense, because that to me is a statement of, we're going to give more faith to Kulusevski, we're going to give more faith to Dybala, and we're going to focus on Ronaldo. Because to me, it was always going to be very interesting to see. I definitely thought Ronaldo was going to benefit a ton from having Dzeko. I wasn't 100% sure Dybala would. And it'll be very interesting to see how Dybala mixes in with Morata. So Dybala joined Juve right after Morata left. Be interesting to see if they can play together. I was also looking at the stats for the number of starts in Serie A last season for the attackers on Juve, because I also want to ultimately see where are we going to find playing time for these people. So let's look. Higuain surprised me. Last season, he started 20 games in Serie A. He's gone. So can Morata essentially replace Higuain? Yeah, it's possible. And there's a decent amount of starts there. But then this is where it get interesting. I think it's safe to say Bernardeschi's starts is going to decrease from 19, at least as a forward. It's possible that Pirlo reinvents him in a different role. But as far as an attacker, I don't think we'll see much of Bernardeschi. I think those starts are going down. Douglas Costa is gone, but because of his injuries, it's not that you're going to gain a lot of playing time by his departure. And obviously, when we talk about Bernardeschi and Douglas Costa, that impacts Kulusevski and Chiesa, somewhat similar roles. So you have that. So between Douglas Costa and Bernardeschi, there's 26 starts. Those of Douglas Costa, the Bernardeschi ones are going to go down. But there's some other factors. Ramsey, who's been playing well for Pirlo, and again, he's a huge injury risk. He had 11 starts last season. Is it possible that it increases? If he stays healthy, odds are it will. And then last season, Dybala had 25 starts in Serie A. So it's going to be very interesting to see. You know, I think the way Pirlo is using the formation, and he changes it quite a bit, but I think what it's the most similar to is when Allegri switched from the back three and he went with the 4-2-3-1, trying to use all his offensive players at a time. This formation, this Juve of Pirlo, reminds me the most of that. So there's going to be some opportunities for different players, different looks. I always was pretty concerned about Chiesa arriving at Juve that it would impact Kulusevski. Right now, they both are playing together and starting. Let's see what happens when Dybala comes back, and if more, and obviously Ronaldo. So very interesting to see how this is going to shake up. Juve is definitely very deep up front. It'll be interesting to see how they are going to line up. I was on a Juventibus podcast this week, which was really interesting. And right as I was logging off, one of the hosts asked me, you know, if Juve was in a Champions League semifinal, what would my starting lineup look like? And at the end of the day, the tag, gun to the head, I'm still going Kulusevski, Ronaldo, Dybala. But that's leaving a lot of talent on the bench. So it's going to be interesting to see how Pirlo manages this. I think Juve here last season, there was some concerns on their, there was a lot of number of players up front, but maybe not great depth because you couldn't count so much on Ramsey and Douglas Costa. But that's going to change this season. So definitely something to watch. It'll be very interesting to see how Pirlo manages through all this. So now let's get to Lazio. We haven't spoken about them in a while. It's been a good week for them, so we wanted to celebrate their Champions League win. Immobile facing his former team, Dortmund, with our friend Alistair McKenzie. So I'm very excited to talk to my good friend Alistair McKenzie, who we got to know earlier this year. He is a sports journalist based in Rome. Yeah, I was very happy to see he's been starting to write for a lot of different sites. He recently wrote for Mail Online Sport a superb article on Ibrahimovic. You can also read him on Reuters, The Times, 442, but he is also the co-host of Lazio Lounge, a fantastic podcast focused on Lazio. So today we will be chatting with him about the Biancocelesti. So it's great to welcome you back to Calcioland, my friend. Bentornato.
Thank you very much. What a wonderful introduction. I need to get a recording of you saying all that so I can put it on my kind of virtual CV. But no, thank you very much for asking me back on again. It's a pleasure to be here. And obviously, as a Lazio fan, from my perspective, the timing is quite good. Very happy to be on after a big Champions League week.
Absolutely. Yeah, so let's start to before the match, right? Because obviously it felt like Lazio is kind of a team that was going through a hangover after the way last campaign ended. I think it's, and we'll get to their transfer window at the end, I think it's safe to say it wasn't the most exciting for the fans, and the team didn't get off to a great start. So let me ask you, how can that match against Sampdoria was definitely, hopefully, rock bottom if you're a Lazio fan. But let me ask you, like, how concerned were you about the team going into the match against Dortmund?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to lie about that. I think it was a hugely concerning performance against Sampdoria. I mean, I said when we did the Lazio Lounge podcast after that match that I couldn't think of a worse all-round performance from Lazio under Inzaghi, and that's a period that's now over 4 years. It was that bad. They I think if anyone saw that game, they'll have seen how hopeless they were. They didn't get anything right in any aspect of the match, and I guess the most concerning thing about it was that it was kind of the worst part of what's been a fairly bleak run of form ever since we returned from the lockdown. I don't know, in terms of kind of looking at Lazio's prospects for the season as a whole, I wouldn't say I'd given up on the idea of, you know, a Champions League fighter or having a good season, because, you know, Lazio are notoriously quite slow starters anyway. And a similar, you know, thing happened at the start of last season where Lazio had some very bad results at the beginning and then went on a great run. But yeah, I think that the major concern going into the Dortmund game was that, you know, if we can play that badly against Sampdoria and then go up against a team like Dortmund with the attacking options that they've got, and also selection-wise, very little was changing between those matches, it did leave me a little bit worried, because it had been 13 years since Lazio's last Champions League game. We wanted to make a good impression in the opening match, and if they did anything like what they did in Genoa a few days earlier, it was going to be a disaster.
To say the least, and it was pretty much the opposite about that. So tell me, what stood out to you about that game against Dortmund? What were some of the main things that you took away from it?
Well, the main thing really was just that it was a reminder of how good this team actually is. And I think a lot mm-hmm. of people have actually lost sight of that in the last few months. And the narrative changes so quickly in football, as you see. But I mean, don't get me wrong, that was by far their best performance, I think, since they beat Inter back in February, not long before the lockdown came in. But this is an absolutely, you know, brilliant squad full of great talent. And they do have it in them to play at that level. It had almost been forgotten that they're capable of that. But I think what it takes really is to have your big players put in big performances. And what we saw on Tuesday night was Immobile at his best, Alberto at his best, and most importantly for me, Lucas Leiva at his absolute best. And when you have those guys ticking, the whole team functions far more fluidly, and that's when Lazio are capable of putting in this perfectly balanced performance where they were attacking dangerously, they were counter-attacking dangerously, they were able to soak up pressure. They were just playing very intelligently as well, making good decisions and really frustrating Dortmund when they're trying to get back in the match. So it was a complete transformation. We've seen kind of Jekyll and Hyde aspects of this Lazio team before. This time last year, really, it was kind of flipped around the other way, where Lazio were good in the league and terrible in Europe. But hopefully that's not going to be the case this time, and they can actually use this Dortmund game as a springboard into, you know, getting their league form back on track.
Absolutely. So I know you wrote about Ibra this week, which was really good, but you also wrote about Immobile. Obviously, this was a very interesting match for him, and I 100% agree with you that way too much is made about his failures at Dortmund. I also saw some people tweeting that defines his career, and in a way that makes me laugh, because when Immobile retires, the first thing that people are going to mention is that he tied Higuain's record. So sorry, it's not going to be Dortmund. So let me ask you, and I know you're probably even more passionate than I am about this. So what do you make about this situation of Immobile being perceived about Dortmund? And do you think he saw Tuesday's match as revenge? And I put that in air quotes because I know that's something that you're very passionate about.
Yeah, no, I do. I get more worked up about defending Immobile than most other things in life. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it did wind me up a bit, because I think there is just this theme, really, in the Italian media, but actually in the extended media beyond Italy that covers Serie A, of basically just trying to set up Immobile for failure all the time. Yeah. And that's based around this perception of his underperformance for Italy, which, you know, is true. He isn't nearly as effective for Italy as he is for Lazio, but a huge part of that is that he doesn't feed off any confidence whatsoever from his performances in Italy. And he's also not playing in a system that's suited to him, but that's another discussion. And yeah, I think this whole idea of him looking for revenge was just complete nonsense, because a couple of main things I pointed out in that article was that this was 5 years ago, first of all. It was 1 year in his career, and since then, if you list off his achievements, they're absolutely extraordinary. I mean, as well as winning the Golden Boot in Europe last year, you know, he's the first player outside of Messi, Ronaldo, and Suarez to do that in 11 years. And then beyond that, like you said, he matched Higuain's record. There's no player who scored more Serie A goals than him in that time. He's become Lazio's second top scorer of all time. He has nothing to prove to Dortmund, because he has proven his ability as a striker ever since he left then. And I think that it's just really unhealthy to constantly be trying to find new sticks to beat the guy with, because you're not going to. It's not in your interest as an Italy fan to try and make this guy feel worse. So it was a big point of frustration for me. And yeah, the point I was making in that article is essentially that, you know, this isn't, you know, Dortmund are a big club. They're a club I have a lot of time for. I really like them in many ways. But they're not a super club. This isn't a team on the level of Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, who, in which case, maybe one season there can define your career. You know, if you go to one of the world's biggest clubs and you're not up to the mark, fair enough. But this is Dortmund. It's not a club on that level. So I just think it's complete nonsense given the circumstances of his year there, the fact he wasn't given a second season, the fact that he actually scored 4 goals in 6 Champions League games there anyway. You know, I always say, as a rule, when it comes to Serie A, any foreign player who comes into the league deserves a second season, because Serie A has a very unique way of playing. It's very tactical. Everybody always talks about this, who comes in for the first time, and I always think you need that adaptation period. Ciro never got that, so we'll never actually know how much of a failure he really was there. But that's my reduced rant for you.
Well said, well said. So you mentioned this performance against Dortmund that we almost forgot how good Lazio could be. And I completely agree with you. You know, when a new season starts, I go through an exercise. I take a deep dive on the squads. I break down players by ability. And, you know, what stands out to me about Lazio is you still take their 5 best players, and you would take Lazio's 5 best players really against anyone in Serie A. And I think starting lineup-wise, as good as it gets. But Lucas Lieva was brilliant against Dortmund, is 33. Acerbi is also past 30. If you had to pick one of the two, who is more important to the team? We know Acerbi kind of leads the defense, but I see Lucas Lieva as really having a huge impact as well. So what do you think about those two? And if you had to pick one, who do you think is more important to the team?
I can't believe you're making me do this.
I know, it's a hard one. I wouldn't know who put the answer, so I have to ask you.
Like choosing between your children. These two are both absolutely essential to the way Lazio play. Acerbi's importance, as much as anything else, is actually his consistency, because as we've seen already this season, Lazio's defense is very, very injury prone. And even though there are other good defenders in there, like Luis Felipe and Stefan Radu, both of those guys get injured all the time. So Acerbi's importance is almost as much because he's so reliable as because he's so good, because this is a guy who almost broke Javier Zanetti's consecutive appearance record in Serie A last year before he got a suspension. So he's very, very reliable physically. But I would say tactically and in terms of the team balance and the way that the team plays, Lucas Leiva is fundamental, because when he's at his best, like he was on Tuesday, and he's able to break up play but also dictate play from a deep position as well, he allows the rest of the team to be at their best. especially a player like Luis Alberto, he, if he's not being asked to do as much defensively and if he's able to kind of find a bit more space in the center of the pitch, that's when he's going to unlock defenses with those passes like he did for the third goal on Tuesday night. And yeah, Lucas has been absolutely fundamental in Lazio's success under Inzaghi. And when he's not been fit or when he's not been on form, that's really affected the team. This was actually the first time that he's finished 90 minutes since February. I don't think that's a coincidence, yeah. You know, that coincides with Lazio's poor run of form. They lost him for a spell to injury, and then he's not been fit enough to finish games quite often as well. So I think that was, for me, the most encouraging performance of the whole game on Tuesday night was Lucas Leiva, his return to form, and really reminding us that he's not finished yet and he can still play a huge part.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's close on this. I mentioned it at the top. Now, in the grand scheme of things, I actually think Lazio's transfer window really wasn't that bad because they didn't lose anyone significant. The goal, they have a great starting lineup. I think it's fair to say they did improve their depth. I think, you know, there was a lot of disappointment with David Silva and Kumbula and him ending up at Roma. So what do you make about, but at the end of the day, they did improve that depth, didn't lose anyone. I think you can make a case Lazio is better than last season. So let me ask you, what did you make about the window? And is there a player that arrived that intrigues you in particular?
Yeah, no, I mean, we covered this in depth on Lazio Lounge, and I ended up giving it a 6 out of 10 because essentially what you said, the squad is better than last season because they've kept hold of the team that made that unlikely Scudetto push before the lockdown, and they've added positions, you know, depth to positions that needed it, like left wing, like striker, central midfield. The problem was that they never filled the gap in defense, central defense, which was clearly needed, yep, filled and should have really been the priority. And on top of that, I think the fans, you know, given that we've waited so long to get back to the Champions League, the fans had this expectation that there would be a kind of marquee signing who would really, you know, raise the standards around the place. That was supposed to be David Silva. Obviously, that fell through and he changed his mind about it. And I think Lazio, after that, kind of gave up on the idea of getting a player of that caliber as well. So that was a disappointment too. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the word you use there, who intrigues me, I mean, the most intriguing player has to be John Daniel Akpa Akpro, because this guy has come out of absolutely nowhere. He followed in a long tradition of players signing from Salernitana to Lazio because Lazio owns both clubs. So you see either players signing for Lazio and then going to Salernitana or vice versa quite often. But we never really expected that he would end up in the Lazio squad for this season, let alone scoring the winning goal in a game against Dortmund. He's quite an interesting player. You know, he went to the World Cup with the Ivory Coast in 2014. He was playing for Toulouse at the time and doing quite well in French football, but he got some horrible injury problems, ended up getting released, and that was when he was kind of picked up by Salernitana a couple of years ago. And, you know, lots of people, because this tends to be the case, thought that he'd arrived from Salernitana like the likes of Luis Felipe and Thomas Strakosha have done in the past, as a kind of youngster who's been tested out and is now ready for the first team. But Akpa Akpro is actually 28 already, so he's not followed that path. And he's looked really, really good, actually, really impressive every time he's come on. He's always been a substitute, so we're waiting to see what happens when he actually gets an opportunity to go in from the start. But he's a very intriguing player just because he's not someone we expected to pay any attention to whatsoever. Beyond him, I would say Vedat Muriqi is really the big one because that's, you know, Lazio spent a deal worth up to 20 million on him, which is the second biggest in Lotito's entire time as president after Mauro Zarate. And so it's, for Lazio, that is a big money signing. It's also the kind of player Inzaghi's been wanting. He's been after a target man for a while. And he comes with a good reputation as well from his time in Turkey. So we're yet to see much of him. He's only had two appearances off the bench so far, but he'll be a very interesting player to see if he can apply pressure to Correa and Caicedo to take that spot alongside Giroud.
Absolutely. Well, Alistair, I can't thank you enough. Great job. I feel like now I'm much more caught up on Lazio. You gave us a really good perspective on the team. So if you guys enjoyed this appearance, definitely check out Lazio Lounge. A lot of great coverage there. Definitely support Alistair's articles. If you like Serie A, they're really excellent. He is based in Italy, which always helps with that. And I look forward to chatting with you again, my friend. Next time we can take a larger dive on Lazio. But thank you so much for giving us this update.
Thanks very much, man. Keep up the good work.
All right. Good stuff on Lazio from Alistair. And now let's get to game picks with you and Thousand Names, David. Let's look ahead to the weekend. Let's make some picks. Who you guys picking?
All right. And by the way, as I mentioned on Tuesday, Thousand Names, 3 for 3 last week. So, you know, I always tell you guys to kind of take them with a grain of salt. I hope last weekend was an exception because good job by him. The Juve Crotone draw was not easy to predict. I think the other ones, although Napoli, Atalanta, and the Derby by were no mean gimmies, the hard one was Juve. So kudos to him. So let's see what Thousand Names has for us this week. First up, Juve hosting Verona. And by the way, if you haven't heard our interview with Rick Hoff on from Tuesday on Verona, it was really, really excellent. Something a little different, but 1,000 has Juve winning 2-1. Goals by Faraoni, Kulusevski, great job, 1,000, Morata. And he says, though, that Pirlo is going to get ahead with a help from the referee. And he said that there's another step back as far as the quality of Juve's gameplay. 1,000 Names says that Allegri is going to be at the stadium on Sunday for this game and that he wants to return. So, Pirlo, watch out. Allegri is looming. In Italian, Juve Verona, 2-1, Faraoni, Kulusevski, Morata, Pirlo avanti con l'aiutino, ancora un passo indietro sul piano del gioco, Allegri allo stadium, vuole tornare, fidatevi. So, I like Verona. I've been telling you guys, I think a lot of people are underrating them. They are coming off the draw against Genoa. They will always make it hard for opposing teams, but I am going to agree with Morata. Juve needs a win in Serie A to the draw against Crotone. I'm going to go 1-0 Juve, and I'm going to agree with 1,000. Let's give a goal to Kulusevski. Next up, Derby of the Sud. Napoli travels to Benevento. They don't travel very far. 1,000 has Napoli winning 3-0 with a hat trick by Osimhen. And he says Gattuso is going to destroy Pippo Inzaghi in the showdown between Milan legends. He said Osimhen is a mix between Eto and Drogba, and that De Laurentiis is already dreaming of selling him for 200 million euro. In Italian, Benevento Napoli, 0-3, Osimhen tripletta, Gattuso distrugge Pippo nella sfida tra leggenda milanista, il nigeriano mix tra Eto e Drogba. De Laurentiis già sogna la cessione a 200 milioni. Love Osimhen, maybe not quite to this extent. You will hear 1,000 Names and I chat about him in a second. I'm going to go Napoli, not quite this decisively. I'll have Napoli winning 2-1. I'll give a goal to Lapadula. I'll give a goal to Osimhen and one to Lozano, who is in fuego right now. And last up, this is actually going to be this afternoon. We're recording Friday morning. Sassuolo hosting Torino. 1,000 Names hurts me here by saying it's going to be a draw. He has Belotti and Berardi scoring. He says Caputo is going to miss a penalty. He says Locatelli is going to get a red card. And he said in the showdown between the prophets of the beautiful style but with an empty trophy case, the big winner is going to be boredom. Quite an artist, 1,000 Names. And he says Torino president Cairo is going to ask for the current season to be suspended and that people at Gazzetta dello Sport are going to be in tears. For people that don't know, Torino owner Cairo, his company that he owns Gazzetta. So, in Italian, Sassuolo Torino 1-1, Belotti Berardi, Caputo sbaglia rigore, Locatelli espulso. Nella sfida tra profeti del bel calcio della bacheca vuota trionfa la noia. Cairo chiede la sospensione del campionato, Gazzetta in lacrime. great comment, Thousand, but we are not going to pick against Sassuolo on here as long as I'm in charge. So I'm going to go Sassuolo 3-1. I will give Belotti a goal. I'll give Berardi, Caputo, and Burabbia a goal. So thank you, Thousand. Always a great time to get your picks. Okay, so before we get to Napoli Outsider, for everyone, let's get to our patrons. As I mentioned, Napoli Outsider is going to be on once a month. You will hear him for free on Napoli. If you want to hear his thoughts on all of Serie A, consider becoming a patron. I don't make a penny off patron. It's to cover the cost of the podcast and pay our freelance writers. Whatever's left, we donate, and we make a nice donation every month to the Insuperabili, a great nonprofit in Italy that runs camps for kids with disability where they can play calcio. Really a fantastic organization. So if you enjoy Calcio Land and you want to do something good around the holidays, consider becoming a patron. Okay, this is definitely one of the highlights of the month for me, is when I record with my dear friend Napoli Outsider. We've done a lot of pods together, and we have a very nice routine. Everyone will hear him once a month talking about Napoli. That's what you guys know him for. He's been outstanding with that. But anyone who knows him knows he's an astute observer of all things calcio. So for our patrons, we also have a longer part of the interview where we delve into some other Serie A storyline. So without further ado, my dear friend Napoli Outsider, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Bentornato to Calcio Land.
Hey, it's always a delight to be here. Nice to be talking culture with you guys.
All right, so let's start here. And you know, it was inevitable that I had to ask you this. It's been, kind of looming around Napoli for a while. So I'm just going to keep it very open-ended. I haven't talked about it too much on the pod, but I'm very curious to get your opinion. So what did you make of the situation regarding the Juve Napoli game that didn't actually happen? I'm just going to leave it very open-ended and just get your take on it.
Well, this was a very sticky situation for everybody involved, and it wasn't a good page, obviously, regardless of your perspective on it. Everybody wants the games to be played on the pitch, and when it doesn't happen, everybody loses. Now, that being said, I don't want to rehash arguments that I'm sure everybody has read and learned about, but I want to point out, I want to take it from a different perspective. I want to offer a different point of view and highlight one important thing for me. Everybody in the calcio business, in the sports business, has basically been against Napoli's position, and everybody outside of it has been in favor, and I think it highlights the real reason for which there has been this huge divide between the two positions. Now, first of all, we have to say that it's not that Napoli didn't want to play. Napoli wanted to play. They were stopped by their local sanitary authority. Now, the sports judge still didn't consider that to be a valid excuse for a simple reason, because they said when you got the communication on Saturday, it wasn't 100% clear. And instead of asking for further clarification, you should have just taken off and played. And the further clarification, which Napoli asked, said, yes, you are interpreting it correctly. You should not leave. So that executive order was actually accepted by the judge. But he says that order arrived too late. So now the point here, the real important point, is not so much whether what should Napoli have done, is why are the positions so calcified, so cemented, whereas the sports judge and all the sports establishments wanted Napoli to play, whereas, for example, lawyers and people outside sport are saying that Napoli did well not to travel. I think this is tied to something that has been revealed in the past few weeks. As you might recall, like a lot of teams have posted huge losses from last year. I know that this doesn't seem to be connected, but bear with me, and I promise it will make a lot of sense. Last year, Milan and Roma lost about 200 million euros. Inter has lost about 150. Juventus has lost about 100. And they actually moved one-third of their salaries to this year. So yeah, their actual losses are probably way bigger than that. So these kinds of losses took place in a year that actually managed to complete itself, because the Serie A season actually still ended. The Champions League season ended. And until March, everybody was in the stand. So just 3 months, basically, of weirdness, of COVID-related weirdness, caused these incredible losses. Now, think what would happen this year. Now, this year, the whole season is being played without fans in the stands. What would happen if the season did not complete itself? We would see unthinkable losses. So it's obvious that regardless of rules, regardless of laws, the sports establishment or the Serie A establishment needs to play. So what they're saying is you have to play. No matter what, you have to keep playing, because if you don't play, the teams might just fold. You know, you might have to bring your books to the court and just cancel the team, because there would be too many losses. So that's why people from outside sports, well, they're saying, hey, Napoli followed the Italian laws. They couldn't leave, which is true. Whereas guys from inside sports are saying, well, you know what? They should have played regardless, because there's so much at stake that goes beyond, I don't want to say beyond the Italian laws, but there's too much at risk. So the fact here is that Napoli did follow laws, but, and that's why I am very confident that this will get overturned eventually, not in the sports appeals court, but once they get into a civil court, that this mm-hmm. will get overturned. But the question is, and this stretches way beyond the scope of the simple Juventus-Napoli game, because you also have to think about one more thing. The season, starting so late, does not have many slots to have makeup games. And this is the first thing. The second thing is that this happened to Juventus and Napoli, who are the two single Italian teams with the busiest schedules, because they're expected to go very, very deep into their European Cups. Obviously, Juventus, they think they're going to challenge for the Champions League. Napoli, they're going to play in the Europa League, and they're arguably among the five strongest teams. So they're both poised to make deep runs, in theory. They also always make deep runs in the Italian Cup. And in fact, that was the final last year. And if you want one more, they're going to play the Super Cup, which still does not have a date. So they cannot find a date for the Super Cup, but they need to find a date for a makeup game. That's going to be impossible. And moreover, if there are going to be more makeup games, completing the season is going to be 100% impossible, and this is going to cause too many losses. That's why Serie A needs games to be played. Now, there's one kicker in here. UEFA has said similar things. In the Champions League preliminary rounds, two teams were knocked out by not playing. They lost. And one was Slovan Bratislava. They had to play away to Klaksvik, which is a Faroe Island team. And they were blocked by the Faroe Island sanitary authorities. So they were not blocked by the Slovakian authorities. They were blocked by the Faroe Island authorities. And what UEFA said is, okay, we are going to try to reschedule this 48 hours from now. Now, that was not possible. They couldn't do it. So they just gave Slovan a 3-0 loss. So Slovan were blocked by a foreign authority, and they were just awarded the loss, and they were taken out of the Champions League. And this also happened with Pristina, a Kosovo team, that lost to a Gibraltar team, 3-0. Same exact thing. So UEFA said, but there's a difference between the two protocols that not many have pointed out, but it's crucial to Napoli's situation. The difference is that UEFA basically just said their protocol is very simple. It says you have to play. If you cannot play, we'll reschedule. And if we cannot find the rescheduling date, you will lose. But they're not saying you will lose and you will, you will be fined, or you will have to wear a stigma of some kind. Like in a non-COVID year, if you do not show up for games, you actually get disqualified for the following years. But this year, they're just saying, hey, if you cannot play, you will lose, but you will not get any share of the blame or anything. The Italian protocol, on the other side, they could have done the same thing. They could have said, hey, you will lose and it's just bad luck. But they didn't. They said, you will lose unless local sanitary authorities intervene. And this small clause is what the whole case will hinge upon once it hits the civil court. And that's why there's a strong chance Napoli will win. But this is a huge issue for Serie A teams, because they do not have dates. They should have just put something like, if you cannot go, you will lose. But They didn't. They didn't. So it's a poorly written protocol that is going to cause a lot of trouble. And in fact, the sports judge actually didn't just have to give the 3-0 defeat. He had to give the 1-point penalty to Napoli.
Yeah.
Which creates another problem. Now, suppose this happens again to Napoli somehow. The Italian league rules say that if you do not show up for 2 games, you know what happens, right, Dave? Your club gets canceled.
Oh, wow.
Oof. Seriously,
rough.
The penalty is what's called the radiazione.
Damn.
That's what happened this year in Serie C. And that's what UEFA avoided. They just said, hey, if you cannot show up and if we cannot find a makeup date, you lose. But there's no fine, there's no penalty, there's no long-term issue, there's nothing. It's just bad luck, essentially, because of this COVID year. So even teams like Sloman or Pristina, they did not appreciate getting kicked out of Champions League without playing, but they understood. But here, Napoli's actually not just getting the 3-0, it's actually getting the blame. Because they cannot blame the local sanitary authority once they included it in the protocol. They cannot blame it. They just have to bear with it. So they have to shift the blame on Napoli. And that's why Napoli, in my opinion, will win in the civil courthouse. And that's why Serie A is going to have a huge issue. Because suppose it happens again, and it could happen again, because Napoli tomorrow, today it's Wednesday, we're speaking on Wednesday, Napoli tomorrow will play a very similar Genoa situation, because AZ Alkmaar have an outbreak. They have, I think, 18 positives, 13 players. So what if there's a similar situation with similar consequences, and the local sanitary authority stops them again? Serie A then would have no choice but to remove Napoli from Serie A, cancel the club, fold it, and then lose in the civil courthouse for I don't know how much money Napoli would sue them for. So it's a sticky situation. It's a really nasty situation. And I think the main issue is because of how they wrote the protocol. Because if they just said, hey, if you cannot show up, you lose, and that's tough luck, well, they couldn't have had anything to complain about. But because they included the clause about the local sanitary authority, that's kind of a trump card for Napoli, and it's a trump card for the whole Serie A, because again, they cannot give the 1-point penalty, they cannot award any blame or of any kind, and you know, it's not nice. But looking at how the season is going, it seems like a lot of the season is gonna be decided by just dumb luck, you know, guys getting injured at the right time.
Yeah.
Getting COVID at the right time. I was just thinking, for example, about Ibrahimovic getting COVID over the international break. And the only 2 games he skipped were Spezia and Crotone, which were entirely manageable. Now, what if he got COVID and had to skip the derby or the game against Juventus or against Napoli? You know, it's just dumb luck what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's the only way, though, we can manage this season. So I kind of understand it. And I know that there's too much at stake, because this is not just about millionaires or billionaires losing their jobs.
Absolutely.
This is about so many people losing their jobs. So they have to complete the season somehow. The world has to keep turning. But blaming Napoli is not the solution for me. It's just, you know, I think they took the wrong approach. The approach by UEFA was the right one, but they decided to do things the Italian way, as they usually do, and they screwed up.
Okay. Well, yeah, you're right. These are really unprecedented times, and we are dealing with a lot of different things that we normally don't. So thank you for providing that perspective. I promise the rest of the way we are going to talk just calcio, but that was very, very informative. I knew you would have a good perspective on that. So let's start on Napoli, and we have to start with Osimhen, who I have to say has been really fantastic. I've really enjoyed him. Even when he didn't score, I think he's played very well every game. So let me ask you, how impressed you are with him. And what stood out to me is Insigne compared him a little bit to Cavani, saying we haven't had a striker that plays quite this way since Cavani. So what do you make about Osimhen so far? And do you agree with Insigne?
Well, first of all, he hit the ground running. I mean, he's been even better than I expected. He has shown that I knew him as a very athletic, very fast player. But he showed he has more physical solidity than I expected. You know, I thought he was going to get knocked around a bit physically by defenders, but he's rock solid and he's way too strong to move him off the ball. So, you know, with him on the pitch, Napoli scores a goal every 16 minutes. This is not going to happen the whole season, unfortunately. But it's an incredible stat, regardless of who you're facing. Even if you're facing an actual farmer's team, you know, it's just unbelievable. So, yes, he has added a different dimension to Napoli's attack. And I do agree with Insigne with the fact that this is the first time in many, many years that we have a center forward of that type. I'm not sure he's actually the same type of player as Cavani. I think they're very similar athletically, and they are hungry, and they attack the goal. But there are some differences. I mean, Osimhen is probably one of the five fastest players in the whole continent. Cavani, though, he was just a specimen in front of the goal. He was just a cold-blooded killer. Now, I think the fact is, you know, after Cavani left, all the center forwards with Napoli were guys who could pass the ball, create some play. They had Higuain, who was almost like a creative center forward. Mertens obviously wasn't even born a center forward. Milik was another guy who plays very associative type of football. Osimhen, though, even though he showed he can defend the ball, play associative football, he just attacks the goal, creates space. He's a center forward that can do it all. He's been as impressive as he could be. I mean, it's shocking. I thought he would need a little time to just get acquainted with the league. But no, he's just been unbelievable.
Yeah, definitely. I've really, really enjoyed watching him so far. So when you look at the way he plays, and I know it's a fairly small sample size, who do you think is going to benefit more having him on the team between Insigne and Mertens?
I think Mertens, regardless, because, you know, he had become a little too old to play the center forward like he used to. He didn't have the stamina to play 40 or 50 games up front with that kind of dynamic play. Now he's playing a little behind the striker, and Osimhen is taking a few men off him so he can play one-touch football, play into the forwards, play into the wingers, and he's got a little more space for himself as well. So I think Mertens is really going to... I mean, he's been excellent in the first few games, Mertens, playing alongside Osimhen. So, I think this is a huge benefit, but I think the whole team is going to benefit from him. But between those two, I would say Mertens.
Absolutely. So Lozano obviously has been excellent. I think he's the clear favorite for the Galliani. He feels like a new addition award player of the season. He's been great. Bakayoko, who obviously had experience playing for Gattuso. Not too surprising that he'd get off to a strong start despite not really training with the team. So if you had to guess, at the end of the season, who are we going to look back that had a better campaign between Lozano and Bakayoko?
Now, first of all, let me say that I was in Lozano's corner when he was a forgotten man and everybody was piling on him. So right now, I'm not just driving his bandwagon. I'm honking and using my megaphone to let everybody know what's going on, okay? So this is the first thing. Let me say this, because talent, you know, the cream always rises to the top, and you always have to bet on talent. Talent always comes out, no matter what you do. So Lozano is going to have a great season, but, you know, going with your question specifically, I gotta go with Bakayoko, and for a simple reason, because he much like Osimhen, it's not just about him, but it's what happens about around him. You know, he changed the way the team can play, because with him and Fabian Ruiz, Napoli can actually play with two in the midfield, which is not something that you can do, not every day at least, with the other guys. So it's not just about what Bakayoko will do. I think individually, Lozano is probably going to have a better season. But Bakayoko just gives something extra to the team by his physical and tactical characteristics that nobody else can give. And he was such a needed addition. He just fits so well. He looked like the last piece of the puzzle that was needed. So I think looking back to the season, he will be seen as the most important cog between the two guys. I think, although individually, I expect Lozano to keep just mashing. I mean, I expect him to get into double figures, have a great season. You know, people are already eating crow. And, and I mean, he's the top scorer right now in the league, even though it's really early. And he has one fewer game played as opposed to most players, and he's still top scorer. So, but Bakayoko is the guy who's going to change the team and probably change the fortunes of Napoli this year.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And he's going to be one of my picks later on when we discuss Serie A as a whole. So let's talk about Mere, because, you know, I'm going to get to your thoughts on Gattuso so far. I would say maybe this is my only, I don't know if complaint's the right thing, but observation that's a little bit odd at Napoli is Gattuso's obsession with Ospina. And we know he's good with his feet, no doubt about it. So Ospina started 2 games. Mere started 1 game. Mere had a clean sheet that 1 game. But it seems Gattuso keeps going with Ospina. So if I set the over-under for starts in Serie A for Mere at 21.5, so he needs 21 more, do you think he gets there or not?
Well, I think as sad as it is, I think COVID is going to dictate the answer to this question. If Ospina catches COVID, yes. If he doesn't, I don't think so. Although it's going to be very even, I fully expect Meret to start tomorrow with Azed, which would make it two starts each. So like an even workload between them. But I think Gattuso still prefers Ospina a little bit. Although Meret is playing more, is going to play more, so he's going to get eased into the team. And, you know, this is really the last thing, the last issue. But I shouldn't say the word issue, but I think you'll understand. The last issue I have with Gattuso, because I wasn't sure about having him play 4-3-3, and he ditched that. I wasn't sure about playing high possession, high passing, high volume of passing football. I wanted a more vertical Napoli. And he ditched the high volume of passing, and he's playing a more vertical team. He's playing Lozano. So now Meret is really the last obstacle between Gattuso and I becoming best friends. So, but I think he's easing Meret in there a little more and a little more, and the future is definitely his. I was just hoping it would be a little faster. Now, I have to say one thing in favor of Gattuso, though, and about Ospina's feet this year. The goal by Atalanta, which was scored on a 4-0 game, I mean, Napoli had already eased their grip on the game, and even Atalanta, they already knew that it was gone. So that goal, that was literally the only danger Napoli's defense has suffered. And this also goes to speak about Manolas and Koulibaly finally getting a run of games together. Now they're finally both healthy, but finally playing together, and you can see the results. But the thing is, that was the only danger given up in 3 games, which is to say that if that's the situation, then you can actually attribute more value to Ospina's feet, because if you don't get any shots in goal, then having a shot stopper, I'm not going to say it's useless, it's always useful, but it's not as important. I mean, at this point, Napoli's goalkeepers have as many assists as goals given up in the season, because in the same game, on Osimhen's goal, actually, Ospina recorded an assist. So, in fact, they had an assist before they gave up a goal. So, in this situation, I can kind of understand them. Now, if the defense starts to falter and they start to give up a few more shots in goal, then Meret is definitely needed in goal. And still, he's getting eased in there. So, but going back to your exact question, to the over-under of 21.5 in the league, so not just over the whole season,
in the league.
I think right now I would take the under. I would probably say he's going to start between 17 and 19 games.
Hey, you know, that's why I try to make these hard. But you're right. Yeah, that sounds about right to me. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the impact of COVID. And I think this is the first time you and I chatted since the window officially closed. So Koulibaly stayed, and so did Fabian Ruiz. I don't think there was much doubt once COVID broke out that Fabian Ruiz was staying. But I think when we had spoken earlier, and this was probably a while back, you thought there was a possibility that both could leave. So do you think had COVID not happened, both Koulibaly and Fabian Ruiz would be gone? And in your opinion, who was more important that ultimately ended up staying? Obviously, they're both great players, but if you had to been able to pick just one, who would it have been?
As simple as it may sound, the one who did not have a substitute on the market. Because, you know, for example, Koulibaly, if he had gone, Napoli would have picked off Gabriel, who's now playing with Arsenal, and probably one, at least one, between Reguilon and Boga. So you might lose something in the center, but you get younger, and you improve two more positions. So that would have made sense, especially given the age of Koulibaly. Whereas my position, like from months ago, and it's still valid, is that Fabian Ruiz will not leave before the European Championships. So the European Championships have been moved. So in that moment, I knew he was going to stay for sure. And they didn't even survey a substitute for him on the market. So there was no chance he was going to leave. Even without COVID, without the European Championships being played, he was not going to leave. Now, if the European Championships had been played, that would have been tougher. Probably Koulibaly would have stayed and Fabian would have left. But I do not think they would have both left in the same window, because Napoli does not need to operate like that. And we've been over this several times, saying how solid Napoli's finances are.
Yeah.
I know some of your Calcioland fans are saying, yeah, that was a mistake by Napoli not selling Koulibaly. They will pay it on the market next year. They will pay it in their balance books. No. With COVID, even without Champions League, guys, Napoli's finances are rock solid. People say De Laurentiis is greedy. He might be. He might not be. But the thing is, he knows how to run a club. And he knows how not to end up too much in the red. So I mentioned how much other clubs have lost last year. Well, Napoli have lost less than 40 million. They've lost about 25 million, which is entirely manageable because they had about 120 million in the bank, just fresh for any kind of, needed.
Yeah, emergency. The rainy day fund that you told us about. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. They do not need to sell. They will only sell at their conditions. So, and the biggest example is not even Koulibaly or Fabian Ruiz. The biggest example is a guy who has not been included in the Serie A list. He's not been included in the Europa League list, and he's going to leave next year as a free agent. Napoli, instead of selling him at other teams' conditions, they decided to just keep hold of him because they do not need to help other teams. They said, okay, you know what? Well, we might lose some money, but we're not going to help Juventus with Dzeko. We're not going to help Roma get better. We're not going to help anybody because we do not need the money. And that is such a position of strength. People are going to say, yeah, that was a mistake. He's lost money. They might laugh at him. But the thing is, when you do not need money, you're not prisoner of any type of decision. And that's where Napoli is. They can do whatever they want. So they're never going to be as rich as, say, in Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, or Real Madrid, or anything. But they're never going to be left begging for money. They're never going to have to make a poor soccer decision, a poor technical decision because of economic reasons. And they showed it. They can do what they want, and you've got to deal with it. I mean, they'd rather purchase one fewer player than have to sell at other teams' conditions.
Absolutely not. Absolutely, yeah. And trust me, I've said a lot of those listeners straight. I'm glad you reiterated. And what I would add to everything you said is that Koulibaly doesn't have an amortized value, really, that Napoli have to protect or worry about his value. They've amortized it all, basically. So absolutely. And that's why even in a way, and we'll get to it in a bit when we talk about the best sales. To me, even the Alan one, I know a lot of people are like, oh, they left a lot of money on the table. Well, they didn't have much amortized value to worry, but we'll get to that later on.
No, so but you make a great point on this, though, because the thing is, even when and if Koulibaly is going to be sold, let's say just for 50 or even 40, the point is it's all going to be capital gain completely. So who cares, really?
I agree, without a doubt. And that's a very important point that it was lost on some people. So you've talked a little bit about Gattuso's tactics evolving. You mentioned a little bit on the Mere answer. So tell us a little bit more. What stands out to you on what you've watched on Napoli so far this season and the way Gattuso has them playing?
So even before Bakayoko arrived, Napoli started playing more vertically. They stopped caring about holding the ball too much. They go for goal. So they started the game against Parma. It wasn't very convincing. It was a 4-3-3. They kept passing. And then when they subbed in Osimhen and they switched to, you can call it a 4-4-2, a 4-2-4, a 4-2-3-1, the point doesn't change. The point is there are four attacking players, two on the wings, one in the center, and Mertens playing just beside him. At that point, everything changed because Napoli does have the physical presence in the middle of the field, especially when Fabian is on, to play only with a two-man midfield. With Bakayoko, it's like a dam. They have a dam in front of the defense. And they also, should they be bypassed by a long pass, they have speedy defenders like Koulibaly and Manolas that can chase the ball down. So they can play that way. And now they're playing all vertically. They're going straight for the forwards. They're not trying to, you know, build up with short passes, which was becoming a little too predictable. Now they're going for it. And this is what happened with Atalanta. Now, Atalanta are always incredibly dangerous because they play a high press, individual press. So if you have to start from the back, you know, with a lot of short passes, you give them a lot of chances to win tackles and get the ball back when they are very close to your goal. But just going back to, you know, old tactics, let's call them old-time tactics, like long passing, you know, just as I said, Ospina got an assist. What did he do? He just kicked the ball, bypassed the entire team, and the ball was straight to Osimhen. He chested it down, put it on his right foot, kicked and scored. And it was as simple as that. And Napoli only had to win one duel. Because the thing is, if Atalanta is going to play an individual press throughout the whole field, this also conversely means that they're playing a series of one-on-one defensively. So if you just pass the ball to your forwards, once it's there, it's a series of one-on-one. You win the one-on-one, you're through the goal. And this is what happened. So if you just do not go through midfield, if you do not give them a chance to win tackles against your midfielders or against your defenders, then you have other chances to beat them. And this is why Napoli suffered so much against Gasperini when they had Sarri, because they were predictable. They allowed Atalanta to destroy them individually, physically. But against Atalanta, with Gattuso, it was just long ball onto Osimhen, and Osimhen kept beating Palomino every time. And I'm sorry, it's not an even match. If you're going to play Osimhen against Palomino, that's an easy call for Napoli, isn't it? And that's what happened. They scored four goals in the first half. They forced Atalanta to change their shape, which is something that I do not recall happening in the last few years. And that's actually something that works. It's kind of going back in time, reverting to old tactics, maybe. But it's a more direct style of football. It's a more vertical style of football. Less possession, fewer passes, more shots on goal, and more effectiveness. And it's not just Osimhen who's actually gaining from this. It's also Lozano. Lozano has looked like a different guy because he can just get the ball, maybe one touch dribble, and then shoot, and that's it. So I think it's a more... I like this style more. I think it's less predictable. And, you know, Napoli still have the technique to actually go with short passes should they need it. So all is good in Napoli's world right now. We'll see tomorrow, but right now I'm a happy guy, I got to say.
Absolutely. All right. So before we get to chatting about Serie A for our patrons, let me ask you this. Do you see Napoli as realistically being in the mix for the Scudetto? This feels like a very odd season. It not feels, it already is. Do you think Napoli can be in contention for the Scudetto until the end?
You really want to, you want to tease me, right? As a fan, you always want to say yes. You always wish. So, and definitely Napoli have been the team, and Milan fans will forgive me, but Napoli has been the most exciting team to watch in the first few match days for me. And even with the 1-point penalty, which I still am confident at some point will get overturned, even with the 3-0 loss to Juventus, Napoli are still ahead of Inter and level with Juventus on points. And they're only 1 point behind Atalanta. They're ahead of both Roman teams. So you understand that there has to be confidence, but it's so early in the season. And the truth is that regardless, Juventus and Inter have better rosters. And there's 34 match days ahead. And you have to think that they will figure it out and dog it out till the end. I had Napoli finishing fourth, and I think that was supposed to be their goal for this season, just get back into the Champions League. But it's going to be a weird season due to COVID. So you just catch it in the right moment or in the wrong moment, and that's going to shape your season. So I think Napoli's going to be fourth. But what does that mean on the other hand? It also means that if Juventus and Inter for some reason do not figure things out, well then, you know, nice things might happen in the south of Italy. But yeah, right now, money's still on the two big dogs fighting it out.
Okay. So, guys, if you enjoy hearing Napoli Outsider on Napoli and How Can You Not, I definitely recommend considering becoming a patron, because then you'll also hear us chatting about Serie A on a monthly basis. All right, guys, before we head into the weekend, I've been listening to a ton of Van Halen. I don't think I've really been listening to hardly any other band since Eddie passed away. So I wanted to try to do something a little bit different. So I asked Alex to listen to Eruption, which is probably the most famous thing Eddie Van Halen ever recorded. So let me ask you, Alex, when I sent you that video and you hit play and you heard those first 2 minutes, what was your reaction?
My reaction was, wow, this is really a dope guitar segment that sounds incredible, just how I was listening to it very basically on my phone. But my reaction was, holy crap, what would this sound like live? Because I know I have not been to nearly as many concerts as you have, but especially like rock ones where they're really cool guitar riffs. We did go to one together, and my God, was that fun. And I definitely relearned that hearing a guitar like that live is goosebump worthy. And I pretty much got goosebumps from that first 2 minutes there with Eruption before it got into, you know, the next part of the song, which is really famous, you would say. Like, of course I've heard You Really Got Me Going. But yeah, I mean, that guitar was absolutely crazy. In fact, I listened to that a couple times because I've always been kind of, I think I would probably find a bigger home in that genre if I always knew. One day I'll just have to hit you up and say, hey, what are your like top 20 guitar segments or riffs or whatever, because that was fantastic. So yeah, my takeaway from it was, I mean, it grabs your attention right away. Let's just say that. Like, you immediately go on a ride. You don't have to be on hallucinogenics to really feel that and go with that guitar part. But my first takeaway was, what would this sound like live? And I mean that in probably the best way possible. So, yeah, and maybe I'm correct in saying, David, you just don't hear guitar parts like that a lot these days. I'm not saying people aren't capable of it, but is that type of sound a little bit dying?
Absolutely. Well, there's a lot of things, and well said there. It's funny that, you know, we went to that Pearl Jam show together, and Mike McCready is the lead guitarist on
Incredible.
Pearl Jam. He's unbelievable. He's incredible.
And by the way, David, if you remember, he was sick that night, and I came away thinking, first of all, there's no way this guy could be sick. But I mean, no offense to, of course, I love Eddie Vedder, but you can argue that he was just as much of a star in his own way that Eddie Vedder was.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, Mike McCready is a Van Halen disciple. Absolutely. Probably his favorite guitar player. So, yeah, definitely a lot of similarities. You know, what stands out to me about Eruption, it came out in the year I was born, in 1977, 43 years ago. And to me, it still sounds like it came from the future. Like, when I hear that, I was like, what is this? I can only imagine the reaction of someone listening to this in 1977. They've had some amazing DJ sets on Sirius XM with like some of my favorite guitar players, Jerry Cantrell. You had Alex Skolnick, Steve Vai, who essentially replaced Eddie Van Halen when David Lee Roth left the band. And all the awe in which they speak of him is amazing. So I just imagine someone listening to that in 1977. Heavy metal really wasn't in the way we know it today. Absolutely revolutionary. You know what stands out to me about Eddie Van Halen, and Chuck Klosterman said this so well, you know, he emerged right in the apex of punk, where people who really didn't know how to play their instruments could do it. Like, the thing about punk, you and I could pick up a guitar, Alex, and try to write punk songs and be able to do it. But Eddie Van Halen was the exact opposite. Like, I think he must have really, really hated punk, because to be able to play at that level, you had to practice an insane amount. And what stands out to me about Eruption and so much of his work is it sounds really on the verge of completely chaotic, completely crazy, out of tune. It doesn't make sense, but he's always right, always on that cusp without crossing it. Just really, really one of a kind. And the last thing I want to say about Eddie Van Halen, and I've been thinking a lot about it. Here's a guy who was born obviously with amazing talent. No matter what time amount of time you put into practicing, you need the talent. Both his father was a musician, was born in a family a musician, so he had that. He also put in the work. I mean, the guy practiced an insane amount. But in life, even when you're born with like a gift and you're willing to do the work, there's a huge amount of luck involved. And Eddie Van Halen, his brother, is one of the best drummers in rock history. Fantastic. And they had that amazing chemistry that only two brothers can have together. He had Michael Anthony, superb bass player, but more than anything, like amazing backing vocals. The one thing about Van Halen is like the Beach Boys level harmonies. And then he had an unbelievable frontman in David Lee Roth, whose attitude was perfect for him. So even with all his talent and all the work that he did, he still needed a lot of luck. So I'd like for all our listeners and even me going into this weekend, you know, count your blessing, count the coincidences of the things that have helped you in your life. Obviously, on Van Halen's level, they were very big and very obvious. But in all of our lives, we are really helped by the people around us. So I hope everyone has a great weekend, and we look forward to coming back with two more episodes next week.